Right. Then I'm also going to get over to the corner, I guess. Yeah, Natalie, you're going to get over a bit. Again, right? Because
Oh no, I know that we're expecting one more person something to happen.
I can give up my sleep. I'm sleeping. Okay. So let's get set up here. So today, welcome all. Welcome everybody to our talk series. We have the good fortune of having Cheng Yu Wang here, who's visiting for most of the year, right?
Oh yes.
He's splitting his time between here and MIT. And so Cheng Yu has established himself in the computer vision community as one of the leading experts at the problem that he's going to be talking to us about today, which is the data attribution problem. So, you know, especially in the visual generative space, data attribution has been this very, very societally sensitive issue because there's so many artists who make their living, creating and selling art. And you can go to any of these diffusion models and type in their name and get a good facsimile of their artistic style for like pennies of effort. And it's been this huge shock to the artistic community. And people are like, how do we get compensated? So data attribution is all like mixed up in this. A lot of the top technology companies are trying to figure out if they can create different business models based on it. But at the root of it, the technology is very hard to get to work. And so Cheng Yu has been figuring all this stuff out. So Cheng Yu, welcome.
Thank you.
And I'm looking forward to your talk.
Okay. Thanks so much for your introduction. Great. So I think this part of the talk, I'm going to talk about basically what my prior work on data attribution. And second part, I really want to open up for discussion. And basically, I have some thoughts about some ideas, project ideas I want to start on. And if anyone wants to chime in, I think people should just shout out any doubts or thoughts. I think that would be really welcome. And I guess just a quick introduction about my old self. I actually want to share some of my works with David, where in my early PhD years, I didn't work on data attribution, but I worked on stuff where I want to make general model more user interactive. For example, a user can generate a sketch, write a sketch, and then have their own customized model that sort of changes the cat GAN's shape into shape that whatever the user created. And I guess now it's just taking a sketch and fine tune it to make it into different shapes. Okay, this is sort of in my early PhD years, and I really, my personal favorite is actually this one. I think this one is actually where instead of just changing the cat shape into something that's reasonable, you can change it into something that's weird. For example, a user can provide some warping edit to make the cat into a rabbit, and then you can add it again. It's still in GAN days, no diffusions, but and then you can change the cat GAN to really, really weird, no shape into this plus shape with just maybe 5 or 10 user edits. I don't know. Back then I was working on something trying to make artists have their own say for the journal model instead of just make journal model dictate what they do. But I feel like afterwards I sort of started switch directions into data attributions. And I guess here, all we know, there are so many good journal models out there, just to name a few. And the machine learning pipeline has always been I guess nowadays, most models are just taking a lot of training images, have models and have generated images. And actually, although we all know the success of these models come from training images, these data actually come from people. And one thing, the researchers and founder are really excited, the connection between the training images and the contributors are often ignored. So basically, what happens is that they're not getting compensated well enough, and then there are like lawsuits where like Getty Images are suing like Stable Diffusion, and there are a lot of like ongoing stuff. There are Hollywood strikes, artists are not too happy about it. And then people are making like pushback, say no to AI-generated images. Basically, sort of like these data are using without their consent. And I guess recently we have like a Sora 2, probably I should include it in my slides, but I mean, like, probably it's trained on some data that's like, well, it's hard to say, but like, really unsure like whether they get like data that's where we can actually add credit, like assign like proper credit to. Like, we just don't know the source. I feel like this is something that's really important. So I feel like this work, basically the issue of like this issue, why like contributors are often ignored in this case is because although we have like copyright, back then we have copyright from the training image to the contributors, we don't really know how to trace back from the generated image to the training images. So basically what the issue here is like when you generate an image, you don't really know like what training images are responsible. That's why you cannot really trace back credit to the contributors. So that's why we sort of trying to work on data attribution, basically the chain where I'm trying to connect generated image back to the training image to connect creators back to the model. Okay. And I guess the task setup is as follows. You have the data set, you have the text to image monitoring on this data set, and you have a generated image. And then you want to run this data attribution method on this generate staircase. And this data attribution method will query through the data set and then assign influence score and then rank them. So basically you want to assign scores. For example, like these staircase might should have like high influence. You want to get them like higher influence scores and then rank them so that you know like what training images are influential. But the issue here is the challenge for this problem is there's no really a notion of ground truth influence. Like it's different from traditional machine learning approach where we know what it's correct. The only way we could verify this is to intervene in the training process, sort of understand like what is influential. And I'm going to talk about that next. So I guess this one is a work that's 2 years ago about like data attribution using machine learning. So I guess before, what would be a good way to sort of like understand like what training images are influential, right? So given you have a training set, create a text to image model and synthesize image, right? This one is an MS Coco text to image model, by the way. So idea here is like, just to be clear, like the task, the synthesize image is the attribution query, is one to assign like what training data is influential to. One thing we could do is to just create counterfactual subsets. You just remove like training images randomly, then train like multiple versions of the model. And then trying to see like how these models train on random subsets perform on this synthesized image, percentage potentially like log likelihood or resynthesize to see whether it can resynthesize the image. And the idea here is like, if you have like, I think I should prep a little bit more. I forgot the slides a little bit. So the idea here is like if some training sets are really influential, then if you remove them, like these models will lose the capability of synthesize this image. So potentially you have this random subset, you can aggregate the votes, get aggregate information to get this information out. But training, like now you have like two to the n, like combinations of models is too expensive. So I guess a common approach, like maybe people know like influence functions are taking this leave one out approach. So instead of like doing random subset, how about we just like simplify the problem a little bit? So how about we just remove one image and then retrain the model from scratch, have a leave one out model without this image, and then see like how these models like sort of perform on the synthesized image. So we
How do you separate the effect of removing a data point and like retraining with like a different like random seed or like the order of the batch or like I think there are many like other influential.
Yes. So I think right now, So I think for back then, like these models, like right now, like people doesn't really do like remove and retrain for like for developing these method. And let's see, for classifiers, I think people kind of just potentially fix the randomness. I don't see they aggregate like multiple training rounds in terms of collecting random subsets. For leaf one out, I'm going to talk about it. They actually doesn't remove and retrain. They're using approximation to do this. So the issue doesn't exist here. So basically for leaf one out models, you want to evaluate. Basically, if you remove this training image, then this assessment shouldn't generate that well if this training image is influential. But of course, this is very expensive to have all these models like trained and stored in your storage. So the idea of influence function is to take this idea, but they do very, very crude approximation. They take a lot of linear approximations to sort of like estimate this effect and boil us down into this closed form factor. It is basically a gradient of a synthesized image in your loss function and the gradient of your training image. Then in between, there's an inverse Hessian. Okay, so basically what this does is basically assign like the influence score for the each training image xn when you're given like a synthesized image. Okay. And then one issue for this is, you know, like the gradient is really, really high dimensional. So usually they store a low dimensional version where we compute a test time. So that's another like sort of approximation that's been done.
So for on this formula, I'm going to slow you down. Whenever there's a formula, sorry. So Z is the image that you're asking about. That's your query. Is that right?
Exactly.
And then XN is your training data item. You're asking how influential is this item?
Exactly.
And then this is the number that gives you the score.
Exactly.
Okay, so I'm just getting notation.
Oh.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Xn is a training image and Z hat is the synthesized image.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So I guess our idea is whether we can sort of remove this linear approximation for our method. Just it's at a little bit cost of runtime, or actually at the cost of runtime. We want to actually test and see what our best way to sort of remove these approximations and still get the best result. And one idea we have is actually kind of weird, is instead of like removing training image, we want to make the model unlearn the synthesized image. Okay. So instead of like having multiple images all at once for the training image, we just take the synthesized image, run on learnings to have one model that forgets about the synthesized image. Okay. And what we found is that like these unlearned model actually tends to forget like the training image that are influential. Okay. And we assess influence basically by the loss increase. Basically, it's just that after this unlearned model, we directly check like which training image this model tends to have higher loss. And this one is just to be clear about the notation. The difference will be the loss after unlearning. This theta like negative z hat will be the model that's unlearned model, and the theta naught will be the pre-trained model. So that's the difference. Okay, go ahead.
How do you do the unlearning? Is it just you like up change the weights to have high loss on that image and look keep its loss on other images?
Good question.
Okay, cool.
Yes. Sorry, I'm thinking about like the ordering of this one, but I feel like it's hard to get it right. So the learning objective, just like you said, predict accurately, like you have this loss where you want to maximize the loss on the synthesized point, but of course this leads to catastrophic forgetting. So you also want to have a regularization loss where you minimize the loss on the original data set. But of course, like the right term is really, really big because your data set's big. So usually one way to approximate this is to approximate this quadratically. Okay, so in the field of like continual learning, there's a quadratic approximation called elastic weight consolidation. Its derivation is really a little bit similar to influence function. We can talk about it offline if anyone's interested, but it really boils down to this quadratic where it's a quadratic all around like the pre-trained model theta naught, and the quadratic like in the metric is like a Fisher information. Okay. So, and just to be clear, the Fisher information is basically the covariance of your gradients over the model distribution. All right. Okay, so I've been talking about like this roughly works, but what do I mean by roughly works? So then we want to evaluate attribution performance. Let me check the time. So we want to we sort of remove the top K influential images. The idea here is say if we're really think about like these influential images are influential, then how about just remove them? Then like this counterfactual subset, if you train a model without influential images, this model should fail at synthesizing this spectrum. And in fact, like when you run this method, actually, this is what it generates. And just to be clear, this one is you have the pre-trained model and synthesize unlearned model. Just take in the same noise seed, and this is what it generates. And one thing that's interesting is that if you take in the same noise seed but with different text prompts, it tends to generate images that's the same, like the pre-trained model and the unlearned model. Like the leaf KL model, they tend to generate the same thing, even though it feed them the same seed and different text prompt. It will really just like fail to synthesize as this like target.
Is your counterfactual evaluation here also done by unlearning?
No, this one is remove and retrain.
So remove and retrain.
Yes.
I see.
So we just want to make it super clean. So we didn't run any unlearning. So this is the costly way of doing it. So we sort of for evaluation, we okay to sort of like take the high runtime cost, but for actual inference time, we do want to make it like
Faster.
faster. Yeah.
How
Although
big was K that you use here? Like, what percentage of the data set?
percentage of data set, like one is 500. We sweep from 500, 1000, and 4000. 500 is around 0.5% of the data set still have like really effective result. I think this one might be like removing like 1000, just like 1%. So
Oh, sorry. How big is the model and how big is the data set?
the data says MS Coco is around like
Millions, right?
no, it's around 100K.
Okay.
So still like a lot of this work is done on like medium-sized data set. Later I'm going to talk about stable diffusion results, which is actually why I want to discuss with you guys. It doesn't have very positive result, I would say, in my eyes.
So what is this suggesting is that it's sort of like an evidence against compositionality in this compositional capability in these language models. Like if you just remove 500 or 1000 bets, it completely forgets what a bet should look like, right? But that is why I was kind of like asking, like, what is the size of this model and how good are these models,
I see what you mean.
right?
But is it forgetting beds in general, or is it forgetting like this specific
Like white
viewpoint
beds.
of, yeah.
Yes. So basically, like it will start to forget about like neighboring bed as well, but definitely not as drastically as this particular bed. So there's a degree. Yes.
Can I ask? So you said that this is 0.5% of the data set, right? So will it work better if you add more to the data set and yeah, frame it properly?
Yeah, this is something I think I. This is actually a really, really good question. I feel like if the model actually have more data in their data set, it might be more robust to it. That's actually a good point. I haven't think about it super
More
carefully.
robust to. Sorry, we didn't hear the question.
Oh, so I said that he said 0.5% of the data set is being used here, right? What if he adds more to the data set and trains it? So will it work better?
I see. So I feel like in that case, like we, a good answer would be like, then we probably need to take a higher percentage of influential images to sort of remove. We can still pinpoint like what set is influential, but that set would be bigger.
Okay.
Yeah. But I feel like the one issue of this method we've been discussing through like our project meeting is that like it's really hard to sort of decide what is the cutoff for like what set of image what size of the set are considered influential. So this is also like some kind of challenge we're having. So that's why we're having like fixed 500, 1000, 4000 in our evaluation. But ideally we should be able to have a method to decide like what is the set size. But that is still unsolved. Yes.
Do you think that this is like concept dependent? Like the amount of images that you need to remove?
Yes. I think so. But right now I think it's a little unclear. Okay. And the way we're going to check it by the way, it's just to like instead of like just having failed synthesis, like I mentioned, the way we're going to check like how these models fail at like this image, we're going to also check the DDPM loss or the diffusion loss, basically the model loss on this synthesized image to see how much increases. And then we're going to regenerate and have this regenerate process like I mentioned before. Okay. So this is really expensive, but that's why we do it for MS Coco. We cannot really do it for Stable Diffusion. This is the best we can do to sort of like benchmark the performance. Oh, and I guess this is the result for, so on the left is the generated images using the MS Coco model. Definitely not the best model, but like here are some of our results. The top row is our method, and the other method, Dino, is the image similarity method, and the bottom two is influence function based method. So they all look like buses, so maybe it's more direct to just look into like when we say removing like 500 influential image, which is a 0.5 or 0.4% of the data set. And here's what we have, like after resynthesis, like the bus really disappear or get really weird or weirder. And here's like what Dino looks like, although attribute to like similar looking images, for some reason, like when you regen it using the model removing this 500 images, the bus is still there. And here is like the influence function results. And D-track and ours are so like around like the same timing, but.
So Dino means remove the 0.5% of images from the training set that Dino says are most similar to the
exactly
target image, I see.
Exactly. So it's just literally like use the synthesized image and search for the training set what looks similar in the image similarity, image feature space. And turns out that like it's not as effective in certain cases.
And journey track doesn't work either.
Journey track is like an influence function method that's based on like, they're sort of separate into time step. They only do influence function on time step 400. And they found it to be effective back in the time. It's even more effective than directly applying track, which is the influence function variant. And then D-track is the improvement over track that sort of like makes the performance higher. They added like some regularization term, all these things to sort of like improve result. So definitely there's also ends that can be improved on the influence function end.
I see.
Yeah.
Journey track made the image much better.
Yeah, that's right. It's opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any overlap of images between yours and the D-track samples that you found?
Yeah, there are. But usually, like, when you check, like, the overlap is around, like, for each method, actually. I think it's only around, like, 20% or 30%. I did try, like, overlap between... Also, it depends on, like, how much. So if you take, like, 1,000 images, for example, like, top 1,000 images, and then check the overlap, is usually, like, 20%, 30%, around that range. So okay. They are not, like... shared, which is weird.
And still, like, somehow they sort of remove it, which is interesting, right?
Yeah. I think D-track and ours, like, is not, like, super overlapped. So the thing is, I haven't really tried, like, having, like, an ensemble result where you average the scores and then see how things look or check the most agreeable ones. That's something I haven't done. But definitely they don't agree with each other a lot, even though like D-track and ours does like pretty good job
right.
At the same time.
Right. So yeah, I think that part was interesting for me, mm-hmm. The theoretical part, which is they are two almost disjoint sets
mm-hmm.
And somehow still they have the same influence effect.
Yeah.
And the output, which mm-hmm. Questions are, I don't know. I don't know what to question here.
Right.
Is it data?
The artists would fight with each other about who should get paid.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. So it's not like, there's a quote-unquote ground truth yet. It's like each of us say and both perform equally well, like D-track and ours. That's the current state.
So I guess the thing I would like to question is maybe this counterfactual is not the right way to test attribution.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like if I remove 1,000 random buses, do you think it'll have like, oh, it doesn't because Dino doesn't show the effect.
Yeah, so I feel like I haven't tried like removing pick a category and remove it randomly. That's something I have to admit, but we do have a random baseline where we remove random like 500 images. Doesn't really work, which makes sense. Yeah, but category wise, like say, oh, but I do have a version. I mean, oh, I can't answer your question. Let's skip the top plot because we're out of time, but let's just look at the bar plot directly. So the bar plot is like some converted version where we sort of measure like attribution performance. The higher is better. Basically, higher means like your model tends to forget more after removing. And green is the sort of legend. Blue, orange, and green are the budget that you use to remove the image and retrain. Okay. So to answer your question, Rohit, like say clip text is basically when you run like text similarity on text prompt. This is where you get like images with similar categories. So in that case, it's sort of like random categories. A little bit, it's not like entirely true, but here you really get bad performance. So text is not enough in this case. You sort of need like something more. And one thing that's the most you can get like is Dino. Like Dino really gets like the best performance from like the nearest neighbor like feature space. And for influence function, it's really like the D-track is the one that's sort of like on par with ours. But back when like D-track is there, like the influence function, our methods were like beats influence function by removing these approximations. Okay. So yeah, it number wise, it's good. But what does it mean? Like we can discuss it later.
Can I last question, quick question. Does it make sense to add another baseline where you kind of like measure the similarity not according to an external model like Dino, but according to the model that you're trying to edit? So like I wonder if there is a feature space in your model, in the real diffusion model, such that if you do a similarity between features of images, you'll get something that correspond better with the actual like contribution of training data. So you take Dino, might model similarity between images in a way that is different from the model that you are trying to edit.
I'm trying to parse the question again. So Dino finds like images that are more similar, and when you say model, that's tra you're trying. I'm trying to edit is the
The
model,
diffusion model.
the diffusion
So
model.
instead of doing like similarity between Bennett's Dino, you can find like a feature presentation in your diffusion model and measure the similarity between data points or your generated image and training images
Yes.
according to your actual model.
Yes.
Because Dino might model similarity in a different way or consider like similar images in a different way than your diffusion model.
This is a great question. We did try, like we didn't try extensively. What we take is we take the middle chunk of the like the representation in the middle layer of the diffusion model. I believe we take time step like T2 equals 400. I think that's according to like one of the baselines in like one of the diffusion model paper back in the days. Doesn't really work out that well.
Okay,
But
interesting.
one way to answer your question is actually influence function in some sense is taking model gradients as your feature. So in that case, it's actually taking like something, the feature from the model. And maybe like in this particular case, maybe gradient is a relatively good feature to perform this task instead of like finding like what features inside your particular layer. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yes. So here are just some more results. Like you have like some like synthesized image, and then here's the attribution results. And my personal favorite is this cat laying on the clothes there on the suitcase, and get like cats on a suitcase, which is pretty nice. And you can also do local attribution, where, for example, you have the image of a motorbike and a stop sign. You can just take the crop region of this synthesized image and then run on learning loss on this mask region only. If you do this and then run attribution, you can get like attributor training images. I didn't change the text, by the way. I can just like lo locate the locate the pixel space, fix the text, and then run on learning. You can get like different attributor results by different regions. That is kind of interesting.
Actually, I have a question.
Okay.
Can you remind me what the unlearning method is? You do that fast unlearning on each 100K samples for this image.
On the synthesized image.
You take the synthesized image.
So I learn the synthesized image.
And then what do you look at?
Oh, yes, I look at the. Sorry, I think I wasn't super clear here. So you after you have the unlearned model,
Yeah.
like unlearned model basically check through like all the training images, check the losses of the other training images and see how much they increases.
Oh, I see.
So if the unlearned model forgets about this training image more, like
Oh.
the loss will increase more. So this loss change is basically like how we define like what training images are influential.
I see. I see.
So the idea here is like if the unlearned model forgets about tends to forgets more about the influential images. Yeah. And in some sense, if we want to dive in a little bit deeper, the reason why I'm doing this is because I'm sort of leveraging the symmetry here. So in the leaf on our model, in some sense, you're removing one training image, right? And then see how the model performs on the synthesized image.
Right.
So basically, I'm approximating. I have two approximations here. The approximation is, first of all, I approximate leaf on out with unlearning because I can afford remove and retrain using leaf on out. That's the first approximation I'm doing here. The second approximation, instead of like having unlearned model for each training images, which I don't want to store
Right.
on time, I kind of just unlearn the synthesized image. Yeah. And I did a very, very small test on CIFAR. So it's like, I probably shouldn't say this because it's not like an official experiment. I did try like unlearning training image one by one and then do it versus unlearning synthesized image and do it on CIFAR. For some reason, unlearning synthesized image does better.
Oh, wow.
Yes. But it's not like a super solid experiment. So I'm kind of just sharing it unofficially.
Right.
Yes.
So this is a correlation sort of effect which happens, right? You unlearn something and then you're looking at losses.
Yes.
But then causally you are checking it with your counterfactual sort of setup.
Exactly. Exactly. And I feel like one idea is like, although unlearning isn't perfect, but assume we can debate on what it mean by perfect unlearning here. But say if the model really forgets about the synthesized image, while having other concepts kind of untouched, then the loss for unrelated training image should have no change at all.
Right.
That's basically the idea.
Mm.
Yeah. But again, like I'm sort of flipping the causal chain here. Like I feel like in some sense, training image should be the one that's actually causing the synthesized image. I
Right.
shouldn't. This flipping thing is sort of like a little bit not causal here, but I feel like not in the right direction. But right now, it gets the right job done
Yeah,
for now for this model.
I had a question. Let's say like the model forgets this synthesized image of a bed having two pillows which are white in color. So like it forgets and like is it like did you observe any kind of increment in loss for all the objects which are white and related to bed, like a couch which is white, something like that? Like you just told.
Yeah, I think so. I haven't thoroughly checked through labels,
Okay.
but basically when you see through like basically I have this tables of like images which are influential. Basically when you check the top 4,000 images that are influential, they're all kind of like beds, like images with the same category.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So in that case it's definitely category specific. Like I think there are several things. First of all, like images within the same categories are definitely highly influential, but they also need to look similar. Like I think both
Right.
things need to apply to make it work.
Okay. During your unlearning, there's no text, right, when you're doing the loss.
Actually, there's text.
In the loss?
Yeah, because I need to for the model, I feed in like both text and image pair. Yeah, I didn't try like no text
With the
yet.
unconditionally.
Yeah. So that actually could be an issue,
Yeah,
like.
like how do you separate the
So we'll see later. I
okay.
actually start to realize I probably should have done the no token experiment and see how it does. We'll see that later. Like it's sort of like stumble. Like we'll have issues there later.
I see.
Yeah. Alyosha has been telling me about this all the time.
I'm sorry for
I know
that.
I yes. Yes. So okay, great. Right, let's see what time do we have? Okay, great. Like let's see. So let's skip this. Basically, the main idea here is kind of like we're trying to remove some approximation a little bit by doing some tricks, so it improves performance. That's pretty much it. This project basically just as a way for me to understand like what I think about influence function in general as a whole. I feel like unlearning is actually an interesting aspect we should dive into a little bit more. Like, can we actually improve unlearning to have better result? And if so, like, in what way we should improve it? I feel like this will lead to like our discussion later, like if people have some thoughts. Okay, but before that, what's next? I'm going to quickly talk about like basically the next thing I do is this method is too slow. I'm not going to like the issue here is like I need to for me to establish influence, like get influence scores, I need to track the losses for each training sample. And we don't really like for basically in this case, like when we handle one query, although doesn't cost that much memory or storage. Like it takes one epoch of runtime for us to sort of like go through all the training images, check the loss, and like, oh man, it's not going to be scalable. So I guess now, okay, in San Diego, we're going to talk about like, I'm going to talk about how we speed it up. Okay, so I'm gonna skip this. So the idea here is like, we sort of want to improve like attribution performance by learning efficient representations. And how, what do we mean by that? So say we can sort of take this method, we can afford running slow method at first just to gather examples for training. So we just want to learn it. It's a very simple idea that it works somehow. So basically we run our slow method to collect like a data set of like in this triplet, basically you have the synthesized sample, training image, and attribution score. Basically, you have a function want to take in these things and try to actually the function is a little bit wrong. I need to update it. You want to predict the attribution score given the tuple.
Should be equal to.
All right. And then it becomes easy. Like in our traditional learning regime, you just take a encoder for both like training image and synthesized image, get the representation, have a shallow predictor to predict this attribution score. And this attribution score, we can collect it using our slow method so that we can supervise it. And how are you going to do it? Is first of all, we have the synthesized image and the training set, right? And first of all, we run this attribution by unlearning, like our previous method, to sort of like use unlearning to get the attribution scores out, right? So basically, each training set has this like attribution score in yellow. Okay. And then what we're gonna do is like actually this is a key to get it work. Instead of directly regressing the attribution scores, we convert the scores into ranks. So basically the image now is not the scores, it's in terms of like rank. Like basically this one's the first influential, this one's the second influential, all that stuff. And later on we go into our fast attribution, basically just take a feature encoder so then get the embedding of the synthesized image and training image. And then you take the cosine similarity of them so that you have like cosine similarity of like synthesized image, training set, training image 1, 2, 3, 4. And just to be clear, like our encoder is like we take a frozen encoder, which could be any feature space, and then we just learn a shallow like 2 to 3 layer MLP to just like fine-tune the feature. So we're not doing much to the feature, just to calibrate it to sort of like make it predict the rank. How I'm going to predict the rank is we use a cross entropy loss. Basically, we just, if the rank is like from 1 to n, we just divide it by n so that we have like 0 to 1 values so that we can run like cross entropy loss because it's taken like 0 to 1 values and then have the sort of like the cosine similarity to match like these like rank values using cross entropy loss. And of course, we apply sigmoid and some like alpha beta, like some scratching like a scale and bias to it. All right, so that's pretty much it. The idea is pretty simple. And in general, like here is the main result for our method. It's have a pretty big speed up in terms of improvement, in terms of like speed and like, let's see, there's my speed and like storage. So on the y-axis is the attribution performance, is what I mentioned before, the loss change after you remove and retrain. It's still doing this remove and retrain evaluation. On the x-axis is the throughput, like basically how many queries you can perform in a second. So I guess back then on the right, Left side are influence function based methods. This ABU is our original method, which it's really, really slow. Although the storage is okay, it can take like, say, the ABU one really takes just like 438 megabytes, but it's really, really slow. And track and dtrack is slow, is faster, but still like doesn't have really high throughput. The throughput is around like 0.01 queries per second. I'm using one GPU, by the way. Like I'm didn't do any like crazy setup, just one GPU. But using like our method, sort of because it's a similarity based method, you can get like roughly the same like attribution performance as like the state of the art. Definitely slightly lower because it's not perfect, but you get like a lot of speed up out of it with like relatively small storage. It's like 300 megabytes. And it's also outperforming, like, because it's calibrating over the pre-trained features. It's sort of outperforming like the features like in this vertical line. Okay. This one's the MS Coco result, by the way, like run on the MS Coco model.
A query is going through the whole data set?
Query is going through the whole data set, correct?
You can go through it 100 times in
oh,
1 second?
Because you can cache the, you can cache like the sort of like
the
features.
Oh, okay.
The training sense features. That's why you can't have this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're using the MS Coco model, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this question is valid here, but can we make use of attention mechanism or something like that to get more of the results? I'm not sure.
I see. This is a good point. So let's see. So one thing we can definitely potentially do, first of all, this is using attention. The model is using attention. Yeah. So one thing I can directly think of is right now, like we're not like sort of like given a synthesized image, we're not separating into different categories. Can potentially use the attention map to sort of automatically separate like images into different regions.
Okay.
And then trying to attribute that, sort of break the synthesized image down. And then for each part, we attribute separate training images.
Okay.
So every set of training images for each part of the image. I think that could be interesting, just like what I showed at the local attribution one.
Okay.
Yeah. But in terms of improving like the numbers here, I currently can't think of a direct way for now. Yeah. Yes.
So if you're you know, you're doing an embedding based on ABU,
mm-hmm.
Is it possible to make an, you know, use the same technique to speed up any of the other methods? Did you try making an embedding for D-track, or is that possible? Or
I think that's definitely possible. It's just that like I select the one with the highest one in the y-axis.
You don't have any favoritism.
I have to say I definitely have it a little bit, but to be honest, yeah, like ideally you can still take D-track and track to run it, but
mm-hmm.
like the good thing here, it's more efficient in terms of collecting data. It's faster to collect. We have less runtime to collect data.
I see.
That's a good part of it. But I would expect the after calibration, the result be lower. Attribution performance would be lower. I think that's the official answer here. Yes.
You can't cache ABUs. Right? ABU is your previous one.
ABU is my previous one.
Like you have to unlearn one sample and then go through the whole, through the entire diffusion model.
It's to be honest, it's really, really slow. It's,
I don't think it's cache good.
Yes, but I'm going to talk about ways to make data collection more efficient. Like that's actually the main part of this method. It's not just speed up. It's on like recipes to make it faster, but I think it's not that interesting, but we can go through it. So first of all, here are some qualitative results. Like,
Cheng, you have a question for the ranking in the method that you had. You're ranking them equally spaced, or is it based on the...
Good question. So actually, there's a trick to make ranking better. It's actually not equally spaced. It's equally spaced for the nearest neighbor. Like I actually take a nearest neighbor, only run like attribution on the nearest neighbor, and only do ranking on the nearest neighbor set. A large nearest neighbor set, but we're going to talk about that later really quickly. And then you have some like rest of it, like for other like not related data, we can just assign to highest rank. So it's evenly spaced, then everything's like flat here.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So here are some like qualitative examples. You have this generated sample MS Coco image generated broccoli and noodles. And ground truth here is basically like, so quote unquote ground truth is the ABU plus result. And ABU plus, sorry, I forgot to mention this. ABU plus is just a version with a better unlearning method. And I won't go into details here, just a better Fisher information approximation. That's it. And here is basically when you take like say feature that's like dyno plus click text, which is concatenated, and then run nearest neighbor, here's what you get. And then here's like say you take this feature but you have an MLP that fine-tunes it, like you can sort of see like they're studying more matches, and I think there's more broccolis and this matches the patterns of the ground truth more. And then here's the kitchen example where like say the ground truth has more like wood texture, kind of like kitchen. The clip and dyno text basically have some like kitchen images where like you have like wide kitchen, it's not necessarily like woody at all. Like after calibration you can get like something as look more similar to the ground truth. All right. And then one thing is just as an evidence why we want to do predict rank, ignore the ordinal like loss in the middle for now. It's just another ranking based loss that's like slower. Like our cross-entropy loss is like the simplified version. So basically when we did try to regress like over like the sort of like the attribution scores, it doesn't really work that well. So that's why we go into rank and cross-entropy loss. And then also we do some search on what is a good feature space. I think what's interesting here in like say MS Coco here is you can see like when you use clip text, like text embeddings to predict like the sort of like the attribution scores, it doesn't really perform that well. Really need like images, image features like dyno and clip image features to get good performance. But one thing that's interesting is that say if you concatenate image and text features, it becomes like most predictable. You can get like a small boost. So this sort of indicating both signals are kind of needed to get like good like attribution performance.
What's the y-axis MAP?
Oh, sorry, I forgot to explain. Y-axis is basically like the how well like the ranking matches. So we have the rankings that's collected by our method, right? So we sort of held out a little bit of queries and create like quote unquote ground truth. And then we check the top 500, like top 500 attributed images, whether their ranking preserves or not. And mean AP is just the mean average precision to check whether their ranking matches. Yep. And then again, here I'm just going to show the same metric, like mean AP 500. And here is the more data definitely helps, although it plateaus, which is a little bit sad. Like you can see increases very quickly, but later on, like, although it's still increasing, but it's really slow. So maybe you need a better method or a better feature space, like maybe image and text features alone is not enough.
What is this?
This one is like, say, when you increase the data set size.
Of so data set of training the...
Data set of like, like the queries you collect for the attribution samples. So we sort of collect like a lot of attribution examples and then learn like how to predict
the attribute. The MLP, right?
Yeah, okay. MLP.
So it's just 5,000 samples in it?
Yeah, it's not much because it takes some time to collect these.
Like 5,000?
5,000
synthesized images.
Yes, exactly. 5,000 synthesized images. But for each of them, I have like, say, for each query, I have like around 10K like training images rankings. So if you want to look into like the actual like items, there are 5,000 multiplied by 10K. Yes. Thanks for clarification. And I think we're a little bit out of time. So I think, but we should talk about this. So collecting data is actually expensive. Like what you said, like we're not going to sort of like, so ideally, first of all, we want to collect as much queries as possible. But one roadblock is that this, we have a lot of training set. Imagine we want to ship this method to Stable Diffusion. Say Lion has 5 billion images. Are we going to run our method on over 5 billion images? That's probably not going to be efficient. So the question here is, do we need all of them? And the answer is actually no. So one thing we can do is, the solution is that we only generate data that are important. It's actually the gist of this paper. So we found out that nearest neighbor has relatively good performance previously, right? But it's not precise enough. So what if we just take a larger set of nearest neighbor? So for example, like MS Coco is like 100K. We just take 10K of the candidate images, like selected by nearest neighbors, and then only generate data from these nearest neighbors, and then run ranking out of it. And then maybe that's still too big. And what we found is that we can actually still get a pretty reasonable signal by taking random subset on this nearest neighbor set per query. Okay. So in the end, like, we sort of have a more efficient way to collect data for, and one thing is that I haven't sweeped the nearest neighbor size. I fixed the nearest neighbor to 10K. That's the thing I haven't tried. But given the fixed budget, one thing you can see, like, the trade-off would be if we want more query, more diverse queries or more diverse inside samples, we will just take a smaller subset. Less query is bigger subset. And just curious, and I guess we're just curious about seeing like the effect of this. And one thing that's kind of interesting is that, like, it turns out that we can take a pretty small random subset size. For example, on the plot on the left, again, the y-axis is the performance. X-axis is the sort of like the random subset ratio. When you go to the right, it's lower. Basically, you take a more extreme like random subset. And here's the fixed budget. So basically it means like when you go to the right, there's more diverse query, you have more queries. The performance just continues to go up. So that means like maybe it doesn't need to have that dense of the ranking samples to get it work. You just need to take maybe like 10%, 5% of random samples.
You only sample once for each query image?
For each query image, I'm going to sample, for example, on the left, rightmost is 5%. So 5% over 10K is 500. So I sample like 500 training images. So I have 500 rankings for each query. Still have relatively good performance. On the right is, say, I take the maximum amount of query I collected and just fix the queries and sort of randomly drop the random candidate ratio. And say, if you go to the extreme, say, like, I think this one, maybe you just take like, I forgot, like, maybe just like 10 training images, like really doesn't perform that well. So it sort of still need to take like some images that's some train, like training images that's like large enough size to actually have like ranking signals. But so collecting more queries are encouraged, but maybe in the extreme case when we only sample pairs, we're not sure. Like maybe you can just sample pairs if you have like really a lot of queries, but given the amount of queries we have, like we still need to take like maybe 5% of the data. So this one still to be resolved. I think this one is actually interesting because I haven't figured out like the end of this plot on the left plot. Let's say if we go to the extreme, does it always go up or does it go down? Goes down. We could probably only study this if you have more queries, but right now, given the amount of queries, like it will go down anyways. So probably not worth to pursue it for now because it will drop to very, very low. But not sure what will happen if a lot of queries, way more queries. Yes.
So wait, a random query selection percentage. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? Like, so if it means zero, that means I'm collecting the entire.
Oh, zero means nothing. So there shouldn't be zero. Like the minimum is a pair. Like,
one pair per query.
One pair per query. So per query, you'll get like two numbers for the training image. Then you can compare like what is more influential, what is not.
So having more has like adverse effects on your learning?
So basically the idea of this plot is saying like, what is the right strategy of collecting data? Say if you only have a fixed budget, like I can only run like fixed number of like on learning based like attribution result. Then what should I do?
I think the question is whether you want more query images or whether you want more samples per query image. Assuming that you can train on like 1,000 images, do you want The extreme will be one query image and then 1,000 samples for that query image. Obviously, that's not good.
Oh,
the other extreme is like one sample for like 1,000 queries. Mm-hmm. That's not good. So what is the like trade-off between these two?
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Fixed training budget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So basically, given the fixed training budget, the current result is that like you want to make the query as diverse as possible to cover more ground. But basically, the model will need to see more synthesized images
okay.
with the sacrifice of like seeing less like training images. But it's not like you can take like on the right plot is saying like it's not like you can just randomly drop images. Like if you drop like images randomly, the results still like deteriorate. It's just trying to say this. The right one is very obvious. I think the left one is more interesting here. Yeah. Okay. So I feel like if we I probably all the time, but if people are still willing to discuss like what my future plans, I think this is the second part of the thing. Sorry, I take a little bit more time than I thought. But to summarize, I designed a scheme to sort of like calibrate feature space for data attribution. And another gist of it is like, sort of look into what would be a good data collection scheme for this setup, because it's very costly here in terms of like learning to rank. And improvement still plateaus as data set size grows. That's like what we see. So one thing is like, can we have like better ranking loss instead of just like cross entropy, or like maybe frozen encoder is not enough. We actually need to learn fine tune the encoder to get better performance. This is the left to future work. But the thing that really bugs us is like, how about when we scale up to stable diffusion? What happened? Actually, we tried and we here's what we get. So, okay, let me try to look into this. Okay, so on the left is basically a generic sample, a Thunder Warrior helmet, Unreal Engine, 8Ks, and some like lion-like kind of caption. And this is trying to generate a human with a helmet. Okay, and on the top is something that you think that would be reasonable, like you start to find similar looking images where a human with a helmet with the feature space.
Is this a search over the whole Lion dataset?
No, I take, that's a good question. I actually take like 100K. Like clip, or first like retrieve 100K images from using clip embeddings. Later on, I run like influence function, like the unlearning based method. Yeah. So all of these are compared using the same like clip retrieve
function. Oh, so it uses clip as a filter.
Clip as a filter. Out.
Right.
Yeah.
But you did start with the whole training set, and then use clip on it. Which yeah. itself is like a pretty large. I mean, that's
exactly
like billions exactly. of images.
Yes.
Wait, okay. So the ground truth images are not like are from the 10K?
It's
from the full data set.
Two step. Thanks for David's clarification. So you have Lion, 5 billion, and then you select like 100K images using clip embeddings. So you have like this 100K like candidates. So basically, it's a really, really large size so that it can also have something that's related but not relevant. And later on, you re-rank using these three methods over this one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Good point. So one thing that's really bug us like throughout this is just that like when you look at the ground, quote unquote, ground truth, basically the learning-based method, it really just up. Attribute to helmets and stuff like that. It's really just like finding things. Maybe if you look into a caption, the caption doesn't really set like human face. It really just say, maybe there's just a warrior, but there's a helmet in it. So maybe this method is trying to look for helmets, and your calibrated feature also say, hey, maybe I should just look for a helmet or things like that.
Yeah, which is what's ground truth here?
Ground truth is the unlearning based method. So it's not like the real ground truth.
It's the first thing that you yeah. presented, and then ours is your approximation method.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the question here is like, is this ground truth really reliable or not? So that's why we're stumbled upon like, okay, like maybe you should pause a little bit and think about what are we doing here. Yeah. So same thing here. Like here, like the text prompt, if you look into it, a lunar stage with its magical owls looking out into reflection dot, dot, dot. The generated image just doesn't have any owl in it, and it thankfully, like our calibrating method and like the unlearning based method, they really sometimes really like to get some hours out. So I don't know, like it made me start to wonder like whether it is working or not, but it's not like we can actually run remove and retrain on these samples to verify it. I'm already struggling to get this result out because it's really computationally expensive. So I don't know, work hard on this and seeing this is a little bit sad, I have to say. And so I guess the issue here is like it's really hard to evaluate with remove and retrain. And the question here, I feel like I sometimes receive questions saying like, what if the text part is really influential? If you look into the influence construct, maybe the text part is really influencing the loss of the synthesized image a lot. But if that is the case, first of all, we don't know. But if that's the case, also this maybe this output is not what the user would expect. Like imagine like shipping this to like a user, and the user probably won't be super happy about this. Then the next natural thing to do is like, can we actually disentangle the influence between like text and visual attributes? And that's why I'm thinking about looking into this disentanglement through maybe interpretability kind of method is one way to sort of look into this disentanglement a little bit.
So when you say, what if the text is actually influential? Like, so tell me the story there. So like,
So I feel like the thing is, say, okay. So say if you run on learning objective, let's not talk about remove and retrain, but say if you run like gradient ascent on a model with a text image model, I feel like the model has a choice to sort of like increase the loss a lot condition when it sees this text conditions. So basically it's sort of doing a little bit of adversarial attack on this text prompt.
or unconditionally. I see. So is it so you're what you're asking is what you're interested in is the model's association between the text and its appearance,
Yes.
or just the likelihood of this appearance
Yeah.
unconditionally?
Something like that.
And so is it a question about which one we're interested in, or is it a question about which one is the one that characterizes how the model's knowledge is stored?
Good question. So I would say.
So let me put it in the terms of an artist. Okay, so let's say Picasso is alive still and making money selling his art, and he's very unhappy that he's not getting compensated by Adobe. People who come and say, make this thing like Picasso. So there's two possible things. So one is you might be unhappy with the Adobe product knowing how to paint his style, regardless of what text somebody might use. Or he might be unhappy with the fact that his name is associated with
Yes.
the style. And then even if he's just unhappy with the model being able to imitate his style, there's two ways that the model could store that. The model could just know it sort of unconditionally, or the model could store all the information about Picasso's style in some place that's associated with his name. Right. Yeah.
Thanks.
And so I guess, yeah.
But I think what you're seeing here is more than like it's I totally agree with the question. I think the specific question in the result is whether when you do the unlearning and you measure the loss on the training images, are the training images that you like assign with like higher influence are because of the actual image that you generated or because something in the text prompt kind of like pick those images, regardless of the visual representation of the image. So kind of like I think it would be nice to think about disentangle the loss to like text influence and visual influence, but it's something that obviously you cannot do. So it might be that there is an image in your training set that is really matches like the text prompt really well, but that has nothing to do with the generated image. It's not the same style, maybe it doesn't have the same object, completely different. Mm-hmm. But the text really matches that training image.
And would you expect that maybe that training image had a lot of importance?
So my guess is, according to the result, my guess is that less. It seems like when you have a text prompt, you have a large set of images that can match that text prompt, and you actually pick a subset of these that matches the visual appearance of your synthesized image. That's how it looks like. And maybe that's the reason also, if you just do semantic, like pick semantic images according to like text description, it doesn't work, right? Like that suggests that, I think.
Yeah, I feel like that's one possibility. It's just that, like, for example, like text learning how to associate text to image, like even though the image is not that related to like what's actually generated, could be influential. I think another aspect of this, like I'm more also a little bit more suspicious about the unlearning objective I'm doing. I feel like in some sense, it's susceptible that, well, I'm running gradient descent. So in some sense, I'm doing a very severe attack to the model. So in that case, maybe the stable diffusion comes a little bit more unstable, and its direction is more towards like the model just learns how to shout out loud when it sees this text prompt, because that's the easiest way to do to sort of maximize your loss. So I did try some ways to sort of like regularize unlearning a little bit. I did have like some previous attempt where I tried to regularize unlearning to sort of like do this attribution. Didn't got performance gain. For MS Coco though, like I cannot really validate that on stable diffusion. So I did try to alleviate this from happening, but it's really hard. I have to say. Yeah. Unlearning is pretty nasty thing to touch in this space.
Does it even make sense to do unlearning on both the, like, I'm trying to think about unlearning according to what David described. There is actually two different interpretations of unlearning. And it seems like when you try to do unlearning both on the image generation, the text description, you kind of like mix together these two interpretations of unlearning.
Yes. So maybe one way is to really try the null text version.
Yeah. So I have some comments on that. I don't think there is an unlearning method that's perfect in the sense you unlearn it using any of the methods that exist at the moment.
Yes.
There's still multiple ways that you can bring it out.
Mm-hmm.
So like, for instance, we started out with, let's unconditionally remove it with the text. People found, oh, unconditionally, it still appears. And then they started removing also with unconditional.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, oh, there are adversarial prompts you can find to bring it out.
Mm-hmm.
They started removing adversarial prompts. Kevin found like more than 10 ways, even the strongest method, to bring out these images from the model. So I don't know if there is one or if there would ever be one to properly unlearn. And the second point is, I don't know how much to trust the leave one out method too.
Mm-hmm.
Like one relevant work is Joanna's the artless diffusion.
Yes.
You remove one sample of art and retrain the model,
mm-hmm.
it still knows how to generate that particular image through some sort of like compositionalities and
mm-hmm.
learning through different things.
Yes.
Like you remove all watercolor art, just keep oil painting, still knows how to draw watercolor.
Yeah.
Like somehow it composes and learns how to do it. So yeah, I don't, so that's the reason, like, theoretically, even though you're saying we are doing one, leave one out.
Mm-hmm. So like it's more doing unlearning.
Yeah, I don't know if it is, you can like easily split attribution to what the resultant effect of leave one out would be.
Yeah. So I feel like the thing that I do want to mention, although I also feel like unlearning is a really iffy kind of like objective, but I feel like Unlearning is actually a better approach compared to leap find out in terms of fishing out what is influential.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a paper trying to say influence function is actually not approximating leap find out, it's approximating something that's different. And I feel like there's some tie to it, but whether this quote unquote unlearning or like people sometimes name it into different ways, but like whether it should lead to better results is still unclear. I think like sort of in this rabbit hole, like what is a good approach?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but what I have to say is like, that's, I mean, although unlearning is not perfect, that's why people still work on it, because like, yeah. I feel like there's still degrees of improvement. It's not like we can hit perfect all the time.
Yeah.
It's machine learning. It's just trying to make it better and better.
Yeah.
And I feel like, in the realm of attribution, maybe something, what we expect from unlearning could be a little bit different. It's not like we should focus on precision rather than recall. We should make it super, super precise. It's fine that it doesn't completely forget about a concept. That's actually fine. So in this particular setup, we have the leverage to control the degree of removal we want, but we do want to make it super precise, but I just don't know how to.
Yeah.
But at least we don't need to mesh the unlearning literature's competition of trying to completely erase the concept. We erase a little bit, but not erase a lot. Can still attribute, right?
Has there been any discussion of completely different image synthesis approaches that where you might architect the whole system differently in order to be able to solve this attribution problem?
Yeah, so I feel like right now, retrieve augmented generation could be one way. Like, say,
yeah, is there RAG in image synthesis?
I think people tried it in the very early days, but I think nowadays people don't do it for some reason. Maybe because if you do it, usually it'll become like it's copying stuff a little bit too much. Like, say, if you have a subject driven, like
at least image. They get paid.
Oh yes. Yes, at least they get paid. That's true. Yeah. But I guess the question here is like, say if your model, like if the company is still using the more performant model to generate like good result, like these companies still would try to use the better performing model if the retrieval augmented model isn't doing everything they could do. So I feel like they're still still benefit to have like attribution method on these type of models. Yeah, of course we can design like a retrieval based.
Yeah. Like if you had like, what, so you're saying that you're saying the performance gap, like the retrieval methods are not as good.
I feel like it's good for a different type of method. Say if you work on like model customization, image editing, like it's basically a little bit like retrieval based model in some sense. It just doesn't have this retrieval part, but it's basically reference based generation. You have that. But it's not like all the models right now just by default just using reference based generation, just like search for reference and generate it. Different types of modes. Yeah. For reference base, I feel like the issue is already solved like 80%. You can just like attribute to the reference, one or two reference you have. The rest of it, because the model still has some variations over that reference. Whether you want to attribute those variations to the training images might be a little too hard or not at least useful for the users anyways.
Because I feel like this is the kind of thing, like in the human artist domain,
mm-hmm.
right? Like for a human artist, you wouldn't, you know, go into their artistic education and say, oh, you know, I see you made this movie, The Titanic, and made $200 million yesterday. But I went back into your film education and I see that you might have been influenced by my film because, you know, in your second week of film school, you saw my film and I see some similarity between my film and I think that I should get some revenue from The Titanic because you saw my film in film school, right? Like you don't do that, but then at the same time, right? If when making The Titanic, the director,
yeah,
you know, really does have, oh, I'm gonna base it on the book, or I'm gonna base, yeah, I'm gonna use some music. But I'll rescore the music. It won't be exactly the same because, we need to change it for this movie. But like they know what things that they're using. Well, then they'll go and make sure that those people are compensated, right? And I guess that's the, I feel like, I feel like, somehow that's understandable to people, but it's like a different, it's like a different generation algorithm
Yeah.
or something, or there's a generation algorithm with different pieces. So like in language modeling, it's sort of like the difference between short-term and long-term memory, short-term, long-term reasoning, right? Like if you generate stuff that you load into the context and generate stuff that's based on things that are in your context, then it makes a lot of sense to attribute them, say, oh, I'm copying this thing from something short term that I'm thinking about right now, right? But then there's all this general knowledge that the thing learned from pre-training, and it's I'm not sure if the solution is to try to attribute all the way back to things that you learned, 2.5 billion documents ago. Right. And so yeah, you wonder if like image synthesis should be split in the same way. But maybe the retrieval methods don't work.
I
That
wonder
makes sense.
if that's the case, if you'll see a different mechanism, like when you generate an image that was in your training set, like the more like long-term memorization thing, you'll see like a kind of like a reciting mechanism when you generate your image. And when you actually generalize to something new, you'll see a different type of mechanism emerging. Like, I wonder if you can actually do a toy experiment of training a model with many copies of the same training image. At some point, it will output that training image, right?
I think there's some memorization that's going on, like some of them. You can fish out some of the memorized images in these models anyways. Like Carnegie has some papers on it. Yeah. It's not like, but most of the generated images cannot find perfect match.
Oh, so you're saying that like memorization is a different problem than attribution?
Yeah, it's a little bit different, but I feel like the question now is, I think memorization is definitely like the copyright issue. Like we should just fish them out saying, hey, like now it's just copying. I think right now the
You
question's
could detect
about,
that. You could detect that as a post filter. You could say, oh, this is too similar.
yeah, exactly.
Right?
So we can do that.
Yeah.
So I feel like the question now is like from the artist perspective or from a copyright or credit assignment perspective, like what is inspiration and what is copying? And I guess if one argument is that these models are really just like taking this data as inspiration, maybe it's fine. I have to be honest, I don't have a good answer for it for now.
But I feel like, it would be like it might be a satisfying solution to actually design models that copy more intentionally. Like if you could achieve a quality win by giving models permission to copy, but where they would have to compensate whoever they're copying from.
I see.
Then I feel like, oh, that might make everybody happy. It would be kind of like how the reasoning large language models can get a quality win from searching the internet and finding direct doing retrieval and making direct citations. Like they get higher quality results. And it might make sense someday for those cited things to be compensated.
I see.
Right.
I see. So basically, you have sort of like different set of data set pools. One is maybe like more like fair use. You can use it whatever you want. Like, and there's some like data set where you do want to do
That's what I'm wondering.
compensation.
Like, where is this? Like, you've made some interesting progress here, but still seems really difficult, right? And then it makes me think, is there some other approach that we should be taking? Like, what's the ultimate goal is to figure out how to make this technology work in society and not disincentivize all the artists from ever making art again. Like, how do you incentivize them? How do you incentivize writers to write? Mm-hmm. How do you incentivize artists to do art?
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. Incentivize them to keep on providing yes. data.
And then even the your experiments with different ground truths, like the discussion we had in the first 5 minutes where it's like, oh, there's these two different methods mm-hmm. that disagree on 80% of the images.
Yes.
And are there going to be lawsuits about, hey, you know, I know you saw my film in the second week of film school, but it's not the second week of film school that's important. It's the last week of film school that's important. Mm-hmm. And you saw some other thing in the last week of film school. And then you can do all the experiments. And it turns out, oh, well, it depends. They both have about the same amount of influence depending on the way that you measure it.
I know. I think after working on this, I do feel uh-huh. like this pitch of credit assignment, I probably need to adjust the story a little bit.
Yeah.
Because there's so many different ways you can sort of like move around it.
Yeah.
And to sort of like data attribution is an interesting problem, a very hard one, but not sure would be the solution for the future. Like say for this particular problem, for this credit assignment problem, there you can maybe design models just like you mentioned. I feel like it makes total sense actually. This I kind of defeat. I think I don't have a good answer. And I think right now I'm not sure. But one thing, it's already 1:30, so people need to leave. I think I don't want to take much time, but just want to end with, I feel like another thing I've been thinking, although it might not make sense, but like, I was like thinking about like, why do I want to do data attribution? Like, I think why this is interesting to me, actually, personally. If it doesn't make sense, just say it, it's fine. But like, I think in the old days, why, for example, like my undergrad advisor at Liu Xiao, super, super excited about getting data attribution solved, is like coming from maybe his old paper, like texture synthesis. Back in the days, like when we synthesize an image, like it's really easy to explain because we're talking about like what are the units when it comes to generating an image. I think back in the days, the units are just patches. You can trace back the data. Okay, you can synthesize images in patches. Great. And even like later on when he becomes a professor, he has this like image stitching method. Great. Like you synthesize this image composite, can still unit are like pieces of scenes. So you can still attribute back to the data. So you can explain everything super well with data. So in some sense, it's very interpretable. And I guess people sort of take this approach, use segments of units, and things really start to become really weird when, like, and thanks, I'm taking one of your PhD work, David, like, in your networks where the units suddenly are not really data, like, cannot really attribute data back. And the units really here are they neurons or, like, well, you can definitely find some neurons. But I feel like a question now is, like, seems like in the old days when we synthesize an image, we tend to think, yeah, like of course it comes from data. Like there's a natural, like, natural desire where you have an image and kind of think, scratch your head and think about, oh man, like what are these training images? How do model uses and mix and matches these training images to create this piece? But right now, the units is neurons that make things that are kind of like hard. Although, I guess, I'm not sure whether units are actually neurons or not, but like, say, if the natural units of a journey image are neurons, maybe one thing we could do is like, if you have a synthesized image, then we can just say, okay, this synthesized image is actually composited by this neuron, this neuron, this neuron, this neuron. And then we said, okay, actually, these neurons are learned by these data. Maybe that's the more proper way to explain things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but I feel like the challenge here is like, if given a synthesized image, we cannot completely explain the entire image with neurons. I feel like that's actually one thing. When I'm thinking about this, I'm a little bit puzzled. But I do feel like nowadays, because these models learn something that's special, data is actually not the true unit of the synthesized image. That's why, like, when you look into the synthesized image and then attributed images, just look at them and say, okay, these images look similar, but how are they influencing the synthesized image? That's actually the question I want to answer. Instead of actually just like trying to get the influence scores out, I do want to tackle something like this. Although it might be harder, I'm not sure whether I can do it, but this is actually a thing I have in mind. But so I don't know.
So like, do you want to answer for what the right unit is?
Yeah, what the right unit is, and in
what
some senses,
what do you guys think?
From your training data, it all comes from training data somehow. I just don't know how.
Can I ask you a question? So why do data attribution at the level of like individual data points?
I think that's what he's asking.
Yeah.
It's like, so he says, oh, you know, is the right unit like the image? It's like, that doesn't
right,
make
but,
sense.
But like, for example, yeah. In the like Picasso case or something, like you could like knock out all Picasso images, or like
right.
If it's like some other artists, you could knock out all the, and then like maybe that becomes a easier problem than like at the level of individual images or something like this.
Concepts.
Or yeah,
knock out the whole concept of Picasso.
Yeah.
But like, what if it tries to like synthesize the concept of Picasso by composing some other artist's style, like what Rohit said?
Yeah.
That can also be a problem if you remove a concept entirely from the model.
Yeah, like every artist after Picasso was influenced
artists,
by Picasso.
Yeah, some artists is influenced by Picasso.
There's also like the idea of compositionality or like action, like the fact that you know how to build.
Yeah,
like,
that's
what do you want to forget about here? Like the church or a brick? Or like, is it like each individual component concept inside your image? No, it's something about the combination of them, the compositionality of them.
Yeah.
That makes it.
Yeah, so are we actually able to disentangle them? But I feel like the key here for it, that's why I feel like the attribution in some sense need to put into an interpretability lens on it, because interpretability in some sense is trying to disentangle these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, and now I'm really curious about how can we disentangle these things, and if we can find some of them, then like these concepts are also learned from the data. So that's actually the next thing I probably want to try to do. So
sounds like you want to connect the like computational graph. Like
yeah.
You say, this is the synthesized image. This is the computational graph that brought me to this image. And these are the training set that training images that caused my model to build this computational graph or something like that.
Yeah. So sort of trying to break it all down, but definitely is a bit way too ambitious. I don't think I can actually do this in a year, but it's good to start. So I feel like maybe one thing I've been thinking about is to simplify the problem. Instead of attributing training data to an output sample, I think one thing would be interesting is, because we already know some of the neurons or some of the language models, we have some interesting heads or interesting neurons. Like, how about we can try to attribute training data to the neurons first? We don't need to explain the entire output. Maybe it's too hard. But it's interesting to know, okay, actually these training data are helping these neurons to emerge. Like, that would be super interesting to me. At least understand the model a bit more, if that can be done. And I guess the second question is like, can we actually construct an unlearning objective instead of trying to remove the concept, but use this as a probe to fish out all or most concepts from the sample? Like, these are two things I've been having in mind that I really want to try. So I think that's pretty much it. I'm taking you guys too much time, but that's the end of the talk. I'm just having these ideas floating around. If people have some thoughts, feel free to shout out. I don't know how to tackle it.
I like the latter thought. Mm-hmm. I do about the first thought is good too. I guess it's just more of a question of whether you feel like when you monitor training gradients on a neuron level, whether that actually like would be transitioned to like on a bigger level, it could at some point change and not really be reflective of what happens ultimately.
Yeah, I feel like one thing is, say, if we can locate like one neuron with a certain like like ability to do some computation, whether it's like association with different stuff or representing concept, then one way to do it is like one way to do it is still the remove and retrain. So we can sort of like fish out, like given a neuron, you can attribute to the training data corresponding to that neuron, remove that training data, retrain the model.
Mm-hmm.
If you can use the least amount of training data to remove, but still have the model forget about how to do that thing, that task, I feel like that is a success to me. But basically it's sort of like a concept specific or like concept specific specific attribution, the kind of thing instead of like sample specific. Yeah. I feel like that's interesting to me. So there's a way to evaluate it. I just haven't think really carefully about like how I want to do it. But evaluation is there, I think is a rough picture of evaluation. But bottom line, I'm not sure whether I have a good picture of evaluation, kind of just like some random things. I've been thinking about some sparse autoencoder combined with unlearning thing, but I think that's a bit not fleshed out yet. I probably won't show it for now, but idea here, but these are just two things I'm thinking. I've been thinking about that. Yeah.
I like the core question of what do we care about attribution?
Yeah.
Like especially coming from the targeted users that you have in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like if it's artists, what do they care about? And are we really capturing that or not?
Yeah.
Right? Like for instance, if I take Picasso's one of the famous bedroom painting,
mm-hmm.
and if I try to unlearn it, it'll probably also unlearn bedroom itself, the concept of blue, because it's a lot of blue.
Yeah.
Do we care about that or does the artist care about it? Or is there something else specific?
Mm-hmm.
Like for instance, I like your current project that you're working on at Adobe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, we can't talk about it. I know, but
then I asked Richard, so
yeah. But so like sorry for bringing it up.
Yeah,
but
no,
I'm
happy to say it.
Yeah, maybe it'll be like also nice to think about how we can talk about attribution of a specific thing in an image. Like right now, attribution is for an image. It'll be also nice to look out about attribution for a concept in an image. I don't know how you do it, but
so
it's interesting.
There's the poor man's approximation to a concept, which is, and so you're almost embarrassed when we talked about text conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
You're almost embarrassed to talk about the text. You're like, okay, it's about these images, but we're getting messed up by the text. But you could say, well, a concept is approximately a word,
mm-hmm.
right? We have all this text conditioning. We have all this text scaffolding all over the place. Maybe when you do attribution, first you go through something that's sort of mediated by words. You say, this image has a dog in it. And maybe not any dog. It has this dog. So maybe it's a word image pair, but not like it's a word visual concept pair or something like this. And it has a car in it. The car is kind of like this. But then maybe attribution should go through kind of a word segmented understanding of what's in this image.
What's in this word? Or?
I just generated this avocado chair,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is like this bizarre thing. How do I attribute like where this avocado chair came from?
Mm-hmm.
But you could say, oh well, actually, it's mainly made up of three things. It's made up of this idea of an avocado shape. It's kind of like this,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's associated with the word avocado,
mm-hmm.
and it's associated with a certain kind of chair, mm-hmm. like this. It's associated with the word chair, but not any chair. Kind of a modern chair. It's like kind of looks like this. Right. And it's associated with a certain background setting that I picked. It was unverbalized, but maybe we could verbalize it or something like that.
Interesting.
And then once you've got those like word associated concepts separate, then somebody could understand it. They could say, show me what avocado it is that you have. Well, I have this idea of this avocado. Let me just separate that. And then these are the top 10 images that taught me what an avocado looked like. In this respect, right?
Okay.
Right. Like, so you could scaffold on words as concepts. So like you have this difficulty. So like neurons, I think is one thing is interesting. I think that'll be controversial because there's a lot of issues with neurons
yes.
nowadays. But words are words are okay. I mean, often very close to concepts. I know Sheridan's not here today, right? So I can say that.
Great, great. I think there are already kind of like some works that do that. These like you give them an image and they do the decomposition for not necessarily for words, but for like token embeddings that are kind of like interpretable. So yeah, I guess like a quick experiment will be take an image, decompose it according to one of these methods, and do data attribution to each concept separately. Do you get something that is more, yeah.
I see.
But yeah, I wonder, David, you think that like the interpretable part of like actually giving it a text description is important? Like saying like it's avocado, it's these kind of sofas, something in the background, or you can just say, please, this image, disentangle it to three different representations that are, I don't know, orthogonal, whatever.
Yeah, my real opinion is that like all of this, like the actual application that's driving the need for this is in like a pretty complex social setting. And but I do feel like you're onto something when you say that what people want to understand is something that's rooted in concepts. That like if you went to court and they said my ideas were stolen from me, and the judge says, "Well, explain to me what was stolen here." They would use words. Mm-hmm. They would describe the concepts that mm-hmm. they thought were stolen, right? And so I think that you're on the right track, trying to distill it down to some concept that somebody would explain. Mm-hmm. I think there are other societal things that will probably happen. They're probably underway already right now. I think that people are going to get tired of constant computer generated novelty. Right? I think they already are. Right? And there's going to be this value, this premium that's placed on authenticity, of like human created authenticity. So these sort of retrieval methods where you're like, oh, it's not as good anymore, right? There might actually be a real premium placed on actually being able to, you know, do synthesis that actually does citations and does stuff like this. But like, what's the right way of doing it? It would be to be able to explain, this is not just any random made up person, right? I've chosen a particular child out of the stock photo data set that I thought would be appropriate to your prompt. Here's the child. Their name is Henry Cavett. And if you want to use this child, we can put them in your film. But you know, you might have to pay a licensing fee for that. Or I can just make up a fake person if you'd rather not do that, but then, you know, less authentic. So I think that there's going to be, I think that it's a possibility that people will want that. Yeah.
Interesting.
You know?
I think it makes sense. I feel like so I guess in some sense I sort of connect to I guess music. For example, there's so many automatic like sound synthesis, all these tone synthesis kind of thing. They're all based on the same program to synthesize different kind of waveforms. But there are certain artists, they tune their own knobs to sort of have their special like kind of style. And they can sell it actually. So in some sense, maybe during the model, you can also do something like this. For example, people provide like a certain type of like, I don't know, like knobs, not necessarily just reference, things like that for content creation. That could be interesting as well. I don't know.
Like sending preset.
Yeah.
So there's this whole ecosystem. And I think that you're, so like, I do think that you're onto something, that even if you don't build the whole ecosystem, but if you figure out how to decompose attribution in this kind of way, make it concept based. Maybe the thing to do is to keep an eye on what the ecosystem might be that might use the, like an interpretable decomposition.
I see.
While you're doing it, it's not a purely technological thing that you're devising here. You're also trying, like, the advantage of it being interpretable is that now you could explain it to people, right?
Yeah.
And what value does that have? Is like the question.
I see. In some sense, maybe one way is just embrace the text and just like actually maybe, look into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually a really interesting thought. I think I'll look into it. Oh, and yeah. Okay. And again, in some sense, like, okay. I think about it. Yeah, I guess another issue, well, I probably should, it's just something offline. I think right now we're just dealing with Lion, so that's why text prompts are like kind of noisy, but I don't know.
Yeah, they're
like,
noisy. That's great.
Can just like reprompt it, have a better text prompt. Maybe I can do something better over there. Yeah. Okay. But anyways, I think...
thank you, Shenyu, for the presentation.
Oh, you better thank you. Yes. So...